It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're really going to be digging into the world of phosphorus. How does phosphorus resemble carbon dioxide or plastics or groundwater problems? What are the potential benefits in managing these nutrients? And how do we meet the needs of our growing human population in terms of food production while steering away from the brink, which I think is a great word that someone else coined, of phosphageddon.
I coined that word.
Yay, we'll take it. And with us today is Dr. Jim Elzer, and who's the professor of ecology at the University of Montana, but also you have an appointment in Arizona as well, Jim. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here, Mark.
And I also have with me Dr. Gabriel Filippelli, and you're the Chancellor's Professor, Department of Earth Sciences at Indiana University, and you also are the Executive Director of the Indiana University Environmental Resilience Institute. Welcome, Gabe.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we might want to start helping people understand what is the concern of any kind of nutrients getting into our water system. And generally, I would assume it's from runoff from agriculture or from human waste or that kind of thing. So help us understand what the problem is with nutrients.
Well, it's generally, you know, too much of a good thing. You know, we all know that phosphorus and nitrogen and potassium, you know, are useful in our gardens to make our flowers grow and our lawn green. Same thing is true of agricultural production. To have high yield agriculture, we need to use fertilizer. And so it's all a good thing on that side until it gets out of our hands and slips into the surface waters, into streams, rivers, lakes, coastal oceans. And there, the plants, if you will, the microscopic plants or algae, they grow like crazy too. and we tend not to like that so much. We tend to like our lakes and coastal oceans, you know, bluer and clear. And some of those algae are toxic. When they die and decompose, they strip the oxygen out of the water, kill fish. And these issues are probably the primary impact threat pollutant in water aquatic systems today. Are the non-point source agricultural sources of nutrients are probably the primary listed pollutant most of North America, Europe, and our parts of the world. So yeah, too much of a good thing or something good in the wrong place is the situation we have to deal with.
How do you know, Gabe and Jim, how do we get there with too much getting in there? Is it over-fertilization? I mean, the question I have is how did we get to this to arrive at this point of too much?
Well, if you look at U.S., fertilizer use has actually plateaued for the last 10 or more years, while yields are still going up. So I think that there are cases of overuse in particular locations, in particular times. We just put a lot on the landscape over that period. And a lot on the landscape, still a little bit of that leaking out ends up to a lot in the water. We've changed a lot of practices as well. We've changed different ways that we handle land and how we farm. And then we've also intensified animal production in ways that tend to mobilize nutrients in particular areas with manure and too much manure in one place, not in another. And so that also tends to allow the nutrients to come out of the system in ways that are very damaging. So, so it is a certain extent overuse in some sense, but, you know, in many ways, our but the practices of the total amount of being is not no longer increasing. It's just that there's a lot out there and a lot continues to go, be put down.
Okay. And when you think of the, like the normal Midwestern farmer, let's say, because certainly much of this, you've probably heard of this Gulf of Mexico dead zone, this region that is devoid of oxygen. And as a consequence, has a significant impact on fisheries production there, right? Fish are animals, as are shrimp and others. They need oxygen to survive. Well, much of that is due to phosphate runoff from Midwestern agriculture. So Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, for example. And the farmer does not want to lose fertilizer off of his or her fields, right? That's the key. You don't want to be having that money flushed off of your field. Similarly, there's all kinds of environmental regulations to ensure that that is minimized quite a bit. But inevitably, when you think about it, you did the best you can, you applied fertilizer and seed, and then 2 days later, it rains unexpectedly, right? And these events happen, you know, and if you, maybe not to an individual farm every year, but if you expand that to all of the millions of acres of farmland under soy and soybean and corn production in the Midwest, you could see that there's going to be some leakage off farm fields. And but of course, as Jim mentioned, there's also leakages right out of our sewers, right? And right out of livestock fields. So, and that's another real significant issue.
Yeah. And so those would be like out of a combined feeding operation where there is a large pool of manure and urine building up. And then if it floods, generally that is then washed into the system.
Yeah, there's been a large sort of system level change in agricultural practices, you know, nationwide or globally, right? Where we brought a lot of the animal husbandry and rearing into particular locations around the country. And that, you know, improves the efficiency of operations and you know, makes food in some sense cheaper for people, which, you know, it's a good thing. But on the other hand, it brings too much manure in one place. And when we had more of a mixed agricultural system, it was more practical to be able to bring manure back to the fields and spread it. Now there's just no way you can spread the amount of manure being produced in particular areas. Can't truck it far enough. It's too heavy, right? And so it gets piled up in lagoons and other sorts of systems, maybe treated, maybe not treated. Some of that's leaking out all the time. Some of it's lost catastrophically during flooding. And meanwhile, right, all the farms that are far away from manure operations still need fertilizer. So they're getting the industrial mine fertilizer being added to support their production. So it's sort of a systemic change in which perhaps globalization has a lot to do with it. Economic efficiency has brought, all the pigs are in the Carolinas and Iowa, right? And then large dairy operations are increasing in size, and all the chickens are down in Arkansas and Oklahoma and such. And so it really has made it challenging to keep those nutrients where they belong inside the food system, whereas they might previously have been used to fertilize the feed that they were eating, right? So that's what you want. You want the manure from a cow to be used to grow the corn that's used to make its feed, right? So that would be a sort of a circular system, but it's hard. We don't really have that anymore.
No, and if I understand it right, we're a lot of agriculture is located is in bottomlands or low areas where they may be closest to waterways. And so we have this, particularly that you're talking, Gabe, about the Gulf, but particularly I think through the farming and agriculture areas of the Midwest down through Arkansas and all that, you've got these in low points where they're susceptible to flooding. That's what made them good land. And so I would assume that also aggravates our problem.
Certainly to extent. I mean, when you think of the factory farming for corn and soybean, the reason why we have it in these flat lowlands is that it's really easy to bring large machinery in to do it, right? So these little pocket farms are a thing of the past, you know, pocket farms in little valleys in Pennsylvania, let's say. Right. That's still used for fruit production to some extent, but for grains, it's much more efficient to have them in flat areas. And the flat areas tend to be, you know, especially kind of the wetter flat areas tend to be kind of low. You know, you certainly have flat areas east of the Rockies, but much of that is way too dry. So here in the Midwest, you have that perfect combination of flat enough for factory scale production of grains, plus gets the right amount of rain, well, except for climate change. Usually gets about the right amount of rain at about the right time. And as Jim mentioned, as a consequence of that, plus proper hybridization of seeds, crop yields continue to go up. They keep nudging up.
Which helps us feed a population, but it has its downside, right?
Well, and, you know, we're also feeding our cars.
Yes, that's true. So
a significant percentage of fertilizer application in agricultural farm use is used for production of corn ethanol, which, at least in theory, is designed to reduce the carbon impact of fossil fuel use. Of course, the calculations around whether or not corn ethanol is actually carbon beneficial for climate change is a subject to some debate. It's not obvious that it's actually helping by displacing that fossil fuel use. And, you know, I think something like 25% of fertilizer use is for corn ethanol. It's non-trivial. And that's obviously a very large political football or basketball, to use it now that we're in March Madness, that goes around, and whether or not, you know, we might start to reduce our use of that approach is not obvious. But you have to remember that, you know, not all farming is for food production. And to me, it seems like if we're going to have intensified agriculture and intense fertilizer use, we got to use it for maximum benefit in the food system to feed people. Part of that being using it to grow food, or at least food products. And the second part of that is to think about how we start to change societal sort of approaches on diet, right? So diet is a big driver of overall phosphorus footprint. We've published some papers on that. U.S. has the second highest phosphorus footprint across its entire food system, driven in Argentina's first per capita. And that's driven entirely by how much beef we consume. Beef, like, has a very high carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. It also has a very high phosphorus footprint. Cows don't put on the weight very efficiently. You have to feed them a lot of stuff to get them to produce X amount of product. And so that's part of the issue. And so we need to start figuring out ways we can creatively, productively move to a more efficient dietary mix to reduce the amount of agricultural production we have to support to keep ourselves healthy.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And I think a lot of people think only of the agriculture as being in the food chain, but it's used for a variety of other things, including, you know, corn is used for other things that aren't food. So it's used as, you know, lubricants and other, it's in a lot of things.
That point, I had an isotope geochemist friend who's done work, others have done this, and we are effectively about 30% corn. So about 30% of our carbon in our bodies is corn, believe it or not. I mean, that's how ubiquitous corn and corn products are. And it's not because it's the best thing since sliced bread. It's, as Jim alluded to, there's political and lobbying reasons why we make the ethanol out of corn, and why the farm bill remains probably one of the most significant hurdles or challenges to deal with climate change, with sustainability, and so forth. It's our own rules that are hobbling our options.
That's really fascinating. Thank you, Gabe. So I want to dig in a little bit to phosphorus. So I understand where nitrogen, and maybe our listeners do it. You know, it's around us. It comes out of there, and then it can get fixed by certain things in our soils that help it to be able to go up into the plant. And there's a cycle of that, and it cycles its way back. And while it causes lots of problems, it doesn't cause the problems that phosphorus causes long term. So what is it about phosphorus that makes it so, in a sense, evil to what happens long term? Because you were talking about, Jim, it building up. So that's something, you know, if you've been doing it over a long time, phosphorus hangs around. So what is it about that molecule that's different?
Well, just to go back to nitrogen for a second, its cycle is enormously driven by human activity, right? So most of the nitrogen that we are using is coming from the industrial Haber-Bosch reaction, which uses fossil gas to reduce atmospheric nitrogen to ammonia that can be used to make fertilizer. So right now, not producing nitrogen fertilizer, very carbon intensive process. We need to electrify the Haber-Bosch reaction and move away from fossil driven nitrogen fertilizer production. All right. So having said that, what is it about phosphorus that makes it? It hangs around. It doesn't have a gaseous phase. So like nitrogen does. So nitrogen, it gets fixed out of the atmosphere by legumes or cyanobacteria or industrial processes, goes into the system for a while, and then it can go back to the atmosphere through a process called denitrification, which is a weird word, meaning bacteria that sort of use nitrogen nitrate the way we use oxygen to respire, and they essentially use it to breathe, if you will. And then when they do that, nitrogen gas is produced, and that goes back to the atmosphere, and you get a cycle. It's pretty cool. Phosphorus doesn't have that. It's more of a geological cycle. I'm glad we have Game here. He's a card-carrying geologist. And it comes right now. It comes from phosphate rock, which is mined in Morocco and Florida and some other places around the world, and then comes into the food system and enters our bodies or enters the soil. A lot of it builds up in soil and sits there. It's called legacy phosphorus. It's put in the soil. Crops are taken away, but some of it gets tied up and it doesn't actually get involved in the food system at all. And or some of it ends up at the bottom of a lake or by in a river margin or whatever. It's just there. Right. So we put it out there. We've sort of let the genie out of the bottle, if you will. We took millions of years of phosphate rock accumulation and we sort of flashed it into the biosphere in the course of several decades. And now it's out. The genie's out of the bottle. It's moving around. It's moving into our lakes, rivers, and coastal oceans. And so, and it's not going to go back into an inert gaseous form at all. It can't. Eventually, over geological timescales, it will end up in the bottom of the ocean again and be tied up. But for now, for thousands and thousands of years, this phosphorus is now on the loose, if you will. We need to deal with it. And we can't get that genie back in the bottle, probably. There are ways people are thinking about getting some of that legacy phosphorus back into useful form, but we need to at least put the cap back on the bottle a little and slow the release of that over time. So it's a different beast. Phosphorus is a different beast than nitrogen.
So Gabe, geologically?
Oh boy, this will. You guys have a couple hours? So there's the deep time. Fascinating deep time event that I'd like to touch on at some point during this hour, but specifically to Jim's point about the geological deposits, that's exactly right. It ends up that phosphorus is used just like it is on land in the ocean, right? Phosphorus used by algae, and it accumulates and fish consume it. And eventually they poop it out as organic matter and it's scattered on the seafloor. So if you take any seafloor sample, it has about 0.1 weight percent phosphorus, kind of similar to how much phosphorus is in normal rocks, right? 0.1%. So for some reason, nature chose phosphate 3 billion years ago to build everything on. And maybe it was a bad investment back then. Who knows? I'll wait another 3 billion years and I'll let you know. But so there's not much of this phosphorus in normal marine sediments even, but you get these unique oceanographic conditions which effectively mine and concentrate this element into mineral form, into a very concentrated mineral form on the seafloor. That only happens in a couple places and in a couple times in geologic history. So the main source of modern day phosphate that we use for fertilizers is exactly that. So they form these sometimes thin, sometimes thick deposits of phosphate rock. Examples in Florida, where you can actually just dig down a couple meters, dump the topsoil off, and you've got a nice layer of about a meter thick of phosphate. Or other places like Morocco, where they just have sequence after sequence after sequence of extremely phosphate rich rock. And that's all wonderful. So geologists have figured out where all this stuff is, right? We know where it is, and it's certain grades of phosphate. Some are higher grades, some are lower grades, just like in any ore. Phosphate itself, the rocks have a few challenges when processing them because they have, there's also trace metals, some of them quite dangerous trace metals that are often associated with these deposits. So you kind of have to deal with those in the mining and in refinement. But here we have our modern phosphate fertilizer source are these rocks. And we've moved away from the fact that in the past there was guano-based phosphate deposits. So this is just where birds poop on calcitic islands like atolls in the Pacific. You get these thick deposits and voila, those are all gone. We've mined those all out. In fact, there's cratered islands scattered around the Pacific Ocean that used to have people in them.
It's a tragic colonial impact. The Polynesian people living on those islands have had their cultures destroyed and they've been displaced, and really quite a tragic situation, actually.
Indeed. Yeah, that I was served as a Peace Corps volunteer in the Republic of Kiribati, where one of these islands was Banaba, Ocean Island.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're exactly right, Jim. It's just pits and craters. So there's another one, Nauru, nearby that. And they were all, they were mined to completion by the colonialist owners of those. And then in the case of Kiribati, the British were the ones who did it. And then 1979, after they depleted the island, they're like, oh, now we give you independence. Independence with no income source, effectively.
Right. I mean, you've just really taken away the only tradable resource. And that it also, I can't even imagine the environmental harm to an island. That's a very small place when that happened. So we are running out of, over time, those larger deposits. So is there some concern? Is that, Jim, are we running low or not?
No, yes and no.
Okay.
Yeah, so the good news and bad news, that's a good news and bad news story. You know, the good news is that we're not running out of phosphate rock anytime soon.
Okay.
The bad news is we're not running out of phosphate rock anytime soon. back in the late 2000s, there was a lot of alarm was raised when an analysis came out by a colleague, sort of we're using with available data, you know, and doing a sort of a Hubble peak oil type analysis on estimated reserves and current extraction rates, and interpolating them out and making an estimate that phosphate rock reserves would run out in 50 years or so, and that got a lot of people's attention. It actually got my attention. That was the first time I started paying attention to phosphate rock supplies and this whole issue of where phosphorus comes from. I was always been worried about what it was doing to lakes and such, and then I'd start to ask, well, where's it coming from, and how long do we have to endure this these water quality problems? But since that time, or soon thereafter, some more analysis was made, and larger estimates of the Moroccan reserves were released, and a counter report came out indicating 400 years or something like that of phosphate rock. So the thing to remember, and I can say that this Gabe's a geologist, so he knows this. I'm a biologist, so I was late learning that what the difference between a reserve and a resource is, and the whole realities of economic geology are that it's not in the interest of companies or countries to tell you exactly how much of an economically important material they have.
Right.
So everyone is sort of guessing about what's really out there. And so So I don't think that right now too many people working on this issue are talking very much about running out of phosphorus per se. What we're talking about more is the geopolitical and economic aspects of phosphate rock supply. Morocco, those re-estimates of reserves were entirely confined to Morocco. That is, that's where the reports indicated a lot more phosphate rock was present than what had been accounted for previously. So Morocco essentially, you know, is sitting in the catbird seat, the driver's seat for global phosphorus. They're a friendly country now. They're friendly to the West. They're open to trade. And have a relatively, have a progressive sort of approach to matters. So that's good. On the other hand, things can change, right? You know, political winds can blow in a different direction. And so I think it's reasonable for people or countries in to start asking, you know, well, how long can we count on a particular supplier of phosphate rock? Europe, for example, has no internal supplies of phosphate fertilizer. They have to pretty much import everything. I mean, certainly the fertilizer world woke up again this past year or two after the invasion of Ukraine, right? So fertilizer prices went up again. And so all of this situation with how we run the global fertilizer system, whether it's potassium, which is also connected to geopolitically unstable environments, nitrogen, which is driven by natural gas and its availability, and phosphate rock, which is largely localized in Morocco, a single country, or China, has the second largest set of reserves. I think if countries would be wise to ask themselves, how can we develop a different kind of approach to the phosphorus that we can rely on in the future? And that's why I think we need to start thinking more about and making faster progress on recycling phosphorus from inside the food system where it's moving around. And that would not only, you know, make our food system more stable, more resilient, it would also improve the environment, because a lot of those sources where we'd get the phosphorus from are things we've talked about, manure and human waste and food waste that are polluting the environment now. Imagine if we instead of take that pollution and turn it into a resource, I think that'd be pretty great. And we'd have our own new industry of recycled fertilizer production in the United States. I think it'd be a cool thing.
Yeah, and that's not to mention that, you know, what I think is really interesting about that is the, you know, it's fuel intensive to get it and move it. You know,
phosphate, so, especially if you're not making a phosphate rock used to move from Morocco, get processed elsewhere. They'd move the rock itself.
Right.
Luckily now, Morocco is making its own fertilizer, which is appropriate. They should benefit maximally from adding value to their primary resource in their own country. So now they're more exporting fertilizer, which I think is a good thing. Yeah, but the whole fertilizer industry is massive quantities of stuff, right? The fertilizer is heavy.
Right, and that much of it, you know, separated from the fossil fuels that we're concerned about too. And it just gets kind of crazy. I've been talking with my guests, Jim Elzer and Gabe Filippelli, about the world's phosphorus problems. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
I'm Mark Kiesling, and we're having a conversation with our guests, Jim Elzer and Gabe Filippelli, about the potential benefits of managing nutrients like phosphorus in our environment. And so this idea of phosphorus being there, it's kind of got a legacy on its own. It builds up, it stays because it can't get back in the atmosphere, which I think we that was really great in our first segment. But I want to know, what could we do about this issue with phosphorus? And Jim, you were starting to hint at it. But what are some of the solutions to our phosphorus problem?
Well, the solution space, luckily, is large. So that's a good thing. There's a lot of, some environmental problems had a silver bullet solution, like the ozone hole and CFCs and refrigerants, right? We sort of like nailed it, right? So here we don't have a silver bullet. We need a silver shotgun blast. So we said, so a big target. There's a lot of things we have to take care of at the same time. So no one approach will improve things. What are all those things we ought to be looking at? We talked about it a little bit, recycling more phosphorus than we currently do. Very, very little of what we recycle is of what we use on the land in food production is recycled fertilizers. There's some innovations coming out. There's a company called Astara that precipitates a slow release fertilizer and wastewater treatment plants, and they've commercialized that. It's been field tested. I think there's field tests going on all across the Midwest right now. I've saw recently where they're testing it under different crops and different conditions, see how effective it seems to work pretty well. That's a good one. But the big problem for recycling is not human waste, although that's a good thing to deal with, is animal waste. So we really need to get a better solution for how we manage and handle manure, whether that is manure itself. Manure sheds are now a new concept that are out there, managing the manure shed, like in a given region, where is the manure coming from? Where could it go and be beneficial economically? But really manure has to be processed. And so it has to be turned into a form that's more easily used by farmers. And whether that takes place with the products coming out of anaerobic bioreactors, which are commonly deployed now, especially on dairy operations. We haven't gotten, the products coming from those that are readily adoptable by farmers yet. And I think there are folks working on that could go faster. So recycling, we got to do some better job recycling. Also, food waste is another thing. Talk about food waste. 30% of food is wasted in the United States and globally, actually, if we could do better there. If you don't waste the food, you don't have to grow it in the first place. So, and therefore, you don't have to put the fertilizer down to grow it. So if we did better on food waste to reduce that, that would be a terrific thing to do. And then recycling waste food that is wasted, right? So composting it and other sorts of approaches. Food system things that we talked about. Yeah, we probably should only be using farming to grow food. We shouldn't be farming to grow imaginary products we think are going to help in other issues. So I would love to see us concentrate our farming on growing healthy, nutritious, abundant food for people. And not so much for cars or for even for cows. And that goes to a second point about diet. I'm not a vegetarian, so I'm not going to, I'm not convinced that we got to make everyone a vegetarian to solve this problem. People could eat on a lower meats of a lower phosphorus footprint. So pork, chicken, fish are all lower in phosphorus footprint than beef. So shifting your diet there. Shifting toward more plant-based diets, semi-tarian diets is a good thing. I'm quite excited right now, actually, and I hope this will pan out, about cellular agriculture. I don't know if Gabe or Mark, you've been following that, but this is where you grow meat from stem cells, essentially, and the first stem cell chicken has been offered for sale and approved for sale in Singapore. You can go to a restaurant in Singapore and buy it. Recently, the US FDA has given this approach a general safe to eat approval, that it's generically considered to be a safe approach. And there's lots of venture capital going into cellular agriculture right now. And when I talk to those folks, I think, I believe them when they tell me that these products will be in the grocery store within 5 years. And I think there's a lot of things that need to be worked out about what the environmental impacts of that approach is. But I can't help but think it will be better than what we currently are doing with respect to environmental impacts of meat production. So that's a promising approach there. Gabe, have you been seeing anything else that sort of has caught your eye about innovations that are going to help us with these issues?
I've only seen there was a great list of what's out there. Certainly in the recycling, the sewage phosphate recycling space, Europeans are significantly farther ahead than we are. But that's all right. It's it's global discoveries. But there's some discussion in the past about perennial corn, for example. Perennial wheat. I mean, the problem is that there is phosphate on the landscape. It's just we don't give plants enough time to take it up in a growing season. So our soil phosphorus bank, it's still there. A lot of it is still there. In fact, as Jim mentioned, we've over-fertilized, or in other words, there's a lot of legacy phosphorus in soils in the U.S. and in Europe, as opposed to like Africa, where they have a significant phosphate deficit in terms of fertilizer phosphate. But it's how do you unleash that phosphorus, which has now moved from forms that a plant can get in a day or an hour to forms that, take a month or so, 2 months, in which case that's too slow for a corn plant.
That's a really interesting thing, dealing, and it deals with time. And so coming up with a hybrid, right, that really could live in sort of temperate areas, like even Indiana or Illinois, wouldn't that be a fabulous thing to imagine that it would have time to take up those nutrients that are already there in the soil?
Yeah, so I'll get a plug in for my book, Phosphorus Past and Future, available at online book purveyors near you. We talk about fast-growing, lazy plants. And so during the Green Revolution, we've selected heavily for plants that are high yield, that are amenable to harvest. And the Green Revolution is based on those crop improvements together with irrigation and together with fertilizer application. So we've sort of bred up these high yield varieties, and they're amazing how they perform compared to their ancestors. But we did that in an environment where we sort of gave them everything they wanted in the soil and then some, right? And so they never really had to, work for a living, these crop varieties. But on the other hand, wild plants are tremendously enterprising in how they extract phosphate from soil in terms of root development and organic acid production and getting phosphate from forms that are in the soil that are locked up. We could get those traits re-expressed. They're probably lurking in the genomes of the crop varieties we've bred so far. If we could just unleash them again, and if when we do so, hopefully there's not major trade-offs on yield when we do that. And some of the studies I've seen indicate there's perhaps not. We can get some of those traits back, and then if we had crops that were a bit smarter and more ambitious in going after the soil phosphorus, we would need to use less phosphorus in the first place. And then they might be going after some of these legacy forms of phosphorus that Gabe has mentioned. And that would be a good thing. So smarter plants would help, different, better ways of applying fertilizer on the farm, precision agriculture approaches, artificial intelligence, right, which is revolutionizing everything, is now being developed and being deployed on the farm. So making those innovations targeted at efficient fertilizer application use would also probably help a lot, and hopefully be good for a farmer's bottom line, because farmer doesn't want to spend more fertilizer than they need, and so that would be, that's another place we could do better.
Gabe, one of the things I know you talk about a lot, and it's something that when I teach urban ecology that I'm always trying to get across to people, is the idea of what you would call deep time or long time and something that's short time. And things in the geological world take a very long time. And I don't think people have any beginnings of understanding that. And even what you guys are hinting at, even a growing season seems to be so long for some people that we want to So you want to talk a little bit about time in its relationship to nutrients and the environment?
I'd be more than happy to, of course. So one interesting thing, I think about this a lot in terms of phosphate being, you know, the bioessential. Like I said, there's not much of it out there. If we had evolved on Mars, we'd be in better shape. Mars has twice as much phosphorus as we do in Earth's rocks, but sadly we didn't. But there's this fact that we built life around phosphate, and the photosynthesis that evolved 3 billion years ago or so, you know, that evolved and stuck with us. So we have this feeling that, oh, evolution is ever upward, right? It's we're always getting better. We're always getting more advanced. No, evolution could care less our trajectory. And I think we've chatted about this before. Evolution just says, do you have something that at this moment will allow you to make a, you know, progeny, right? So photosystems for photosynthesis evolved way back when. They are so inefficient compared to a photovoltaic capture of sunlight, for example. So there's even people tinkering with photosynthesis, believe it or not. And even there was a call to try to figure out whether we can use an alternatives for phosphate in some of these photosystems. Well, that doesn't work. It was invoking a pattern that was seen in experiments that ended up being faulty. But we've identified that phosphorus cycle has changed in the past, in the deep time, a billion years ago. It's different than it is now, but it's always been pretty essential to life in the marine setting. And I want to take us back, just because we can. I want to get us on our geologic time machine, go back 373 million years ago. This is a time before dinosaurs were around, but there were organisms up on land tramping about and all that. But we had a really weird landscape then. If we were to go out right now in the forest, you dig deeply and you'd find roots, as Jim mentioned, the roots of these plants, you know, they go down tens of meters, sometimes even more, and soil is very thick. If you went back 373 million years ago, trees hadn't learned how to make roots yet. So there were no roots. It was basically like you were to go out the Pacific Northwest and there's a vast moss field, right? That's all there was. Our planet was covered with moss. Trees didn't know how to extract. I'm anthropomorphizing here a little bit. They couldn't extract this nutrient phosphorus out of anything except the top layer. But voila, they learned how to do two things at the same time. They first learned that if we stand up taller, we can get more sunlight and outcompete our friends, well, our enemies. But if we stand up taller, we have to make something called a root so we can stand up, right? So they did these things in concert, and in a huge evolutionary explosion, forest became a thing, right? Trees became a thing. And in so doing, they mined the rock that was there of the phosphorus that was present in it. There were some guesses about what actually happened in that process. We know from the oceans that there's a big mass extinction event related to the oceans being devoid of oxygen. And so this event was implicated. Well, we published a couple papers on this over the last year, but we actually were able to capture this moment by looking at lake sediment records of phosphate cycling. And you could see exactly that, which is that the trees learned, they didn't do it all at one time. They did it over about 10 million years. So again, this whole idea of time. So they did it over 10 million years. It wasn't, in a flash, but they kept leaking out a bunch of excess phosphorus into the oceans. In so doing, caused this massive ocean mass extinction that lasted about 10 million years. And also because of that, changed climate dynamics. So we went into a deep freeze for a while, which didn't help the mass extinction much, right? Organisms are also very sensitive to temperature. So this is a one-time event. We'll never see it again. Trees already learned how to make roots. We're done. Again, this is evolution. They learned how to make them and it's good enough. But it's to show that the planet is sometimes rocked by these transitory events, these one-time events. Similar, Jim mentioned, you know, we solved the ozone hole. Well, we didn't have an ozone layer 700 million years ago. Finally, it formed. And now, barring some other unforeseen disaster that we bring to ozone, we'll always have ozone. So there's these events through geologic time, which really are just turning over a page, right? A new chapter. And since 373 million years ago, our planet has looked about the same, except for, you know, random dinosaur tromping about, right? So the way that phosphorus works is about the same, But you do occasionally get these big events. And since that big event 373 million years ago, we have had periodic formations of these phosphate rock deposits. And it'll continue on to today. But to Jim's very first point, we have taken this resource, which is aggregated in these very concentrated layers, and dispersed it, right? We're diluting it everywhere. And we can't get that reconcentrated until we wait another about 40 million years or so.
So that answers a really good question, is you can't get it all back out of there, right? It's dispersed so well. Yeah. Right. That how do you pull all that back out? Other than what Jim was saying, some of the suggestions where we could get plants to, you know, go back to being a different way.
We have to work where it is currently concentrated. Currently in the system, it's concentrated in agricultural soils. There's a lot of phosphorus in agricultural soil not available.
Are you there?
There's a lot of phosphorus in animal manures right now. We know where it is.
So just use it.
Exactly. Yeah. We can't let it get out there and be everywhere, dispersed everywhere in the oceans and and everywhere, because it's impossible to get it all back together.
Thank you guys for that. That is really interesting. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists in the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersection of art and science. And we encourage you at home to do the same thing and talk about and discuss things that we were talking about today. And we'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about phosphorus and food and time, deep geologic time and all those. And I wanted to kind of bring us back into a more localized, something that we could get our hands around and our brains around. And that's what happens to areas, and we all know about, that are small, like lakes. Ponds. And I know out on the coastal areas, one of the big concerns that coastal areas are having is, besides all the other things of sea rise, is because a lot of those are using septic systems that create, again, humans give off phosphorus and they get in the environment and it gets legacy. We're seeing in lakes and ponds on the coasts, we're seeing some of the effects, but you're also in Arizona, Jim, and studying some of that. So what is the real effects of these nutrients on our lakes?
Well, I think lakes are the place where the first concerns about phosphorus were raised, right? Where people in the 60s and 70s, lake eutrophication was a big deal. Lots of places like Washington, the Great Lakes, lakes in Europe were all getting green and nasty and until it was identified by some seminal experiments done in Canada by a guy named David Schindler at the Experimental Lakes area, where they actually used lakes themselves as experimental test tubes and demonstrated pretty equivocally that phosphorus was an essential ingredient, perhaps the essential ingredient for triggering algal blooms. There's actually a very famous picture of a lake, a dumbbell-shaped lake named Lake 226. There's so many lakes in Canada, and they give them names, they give them numbers. Lake 226, they divided it in half with a curtain. And on one side, they put organic carbon and nitrogen at levels you would typically get from a sewage treatment plant, for example. On the other side, they put the same amounts of organic carbon, nitrogen, but phosphorus as well. The side with the phosphorus got an enormous bloom of algae. They took a picture of it from a plane. And that picture, I've called it the most powerful image in the history of limnology, limnology being the study of inland waters, because that picture, you didn't need any statistics, you didn't need any graphs or data or whatever. You can show it to your congressional representative or whatever, and it's obvious to them that something's going on. And it was that picture that resulted in large-scale commitment to phosphorus management in North America and Europe and other places, where we implemented wastewater treatment for phosphate removal, and implemented phosphate detergent bans because phosphate and detergent was a major source of domestic phosphorus and sewage. And lo and behold, a lot of places got cleaned up. That's the story of Lake Erie, for example. Lake Erie had tremendous problems with algae blooms in the 60s and 70s, and those largely got cleared up. Other places were also did much better in Europe, et cetera. Until later on, more recently, in the 21st century, really the last 20 years or so, Lake Erie has started to develop algae blooms again. The most famous one being a few years ago when Toledo shut down its drinking water supply because its water intake comes from Lake Erie, had microcystis, is a nasty cyanobacteria bloom going on with toxins that are harmful to human health. Several days they had to have their drinking water turned off. So things sort of, and that is a reflection of a shift of the problem from point source pipes, if you will, from sewage plants and elsewhere where phosphorus was coming to a non-point source diffuse pollution coming mostly from agricultural operations, also landscape disturbance, loss of wetlands and such, but largely due to agricultural operations. So you're right about when you call attention to lakes and things like improperly treated sewage, like septic systems in Cape Cod, where you are, I imagine this is an issue because you have distributed housing that's not close to metropolitan areas where you can and have investment in the infrastructure that it takes. There's solutions for that, but they're not widely implemented yet. But it's sort of an example of how the situation has shifted in water quality and lakes. People love lakes. They have a lot of affection for lakes. The oceans, people love the ocean, but to me, the ocean's kind of scary. And some people love it because it's sort of frightening in scale. Lakes are things are more domestically sized. I think people could develop real comfort with their local pond or lake or whatever, an affection for it. But the algae blooms will come to small lakes too. And they come when we don't control nutrients from all of a sudden the lake is surrounded by cottages. All of a sudden those lakes have aging or inadequate septic infrastructure. And the lake starts to develop algae blooms. And there's a lot of examples of that going on. I'm here in Flathead Lake in Montana, actually, and where we study this lake. This is the largest freshwater lake in the Western United States. It's remarkably beautiful lake, large, not as scary as the ocean, but pretty scary. But people love it. Very clear water, 36 feet water transparency, 40 feet water transparency, beautiful water. But in the 70s and 80s, they also had concerns about algae blooms as the population started to increase and phosphorus started to go up. But they did really smart stuff. They put in a phosphate detergent ban. They put in advanced wastewater treatment. They put in those measures. And the lake has maintained its pristine water quality ever since. And in fact, nutrient loading is declining. So when we do the right thing for our lakes, they will be protected and we can avoid these problems. And then Gabe, I think you've been working on some similar issues.
Yeah, I just want to briefly comment on the fact that lakes are interesting geochemical reservoirs, right? There. So we've been talking a lot about excess and nutrients like phosphorus coming into lake surfaces, right, fueling eutrophication, so fueling this algae growth. But the algae then settle down to the lake bottom, where they can be an additional internal source of phosphate loading from below, especially at times when the oxygen level is a little bit low in lakes. Like let's say that it's not windy, they're stratified, right? We've all been swimming in lakes where the bottom is, you know, our feet are cold, our top is warm, because the lake is still kind of layered. Well, what can happen is that you can get that leaking from below as well that drives this eutrophication. We see this a lot in local drinking water reservoirs here in Indianapolis, where the reservoirs are shallow, some of them are kind of old, and you get you sometimes get years where there's a lot of runoff from a lot of rainfall runoff from the surface, you get a eutrophication event which means you have to treat the water like crazy, or you don't get any rainfall at all, in which case the lake is stratified, reservoir stratified, and you get phosphorus from below. So it's sort of like a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation. And a lot of water managers, you know, they stay up at nights to try to figure out how you keep phosphorus in the bottom sediment so it doesn't leak back up and drive blooms.
Yeah, it's another example of the legacy, right? So once the genie is out of the bottle, it's kind of hard to contain, right? So it's another example of that. So we need to keep the genie in the bottle to the greatest extent that we can.
I think, you know, what's really important and that you're both saying is this idea that it isn't as just simple as looking at, there's runoff. Then we have these other things, right? Things build up. What's happening in the bottom of a lake or stream? What's happening? Those are all a part of it. And we only have a couple minutes, but I really want to help people understand. Jim, can you take me through really quickly what you mean by eutrophication? What's actually happening to cause this algae to do in the environment?
Eutrophication is an ugly word. It just means sort of greening up of a lake or increase in productivity in time. It's a natural process. Lakes over geological time, hundreds and thousands of years, will accumulate nutrients in their basins. They'll get a little shallower. They'll get greener. And productivity will go up over time. And eventually, you know, the fate of most lakes is to fill up with sediments and eventually get, you know, become a forest or a marshland or something like that. And that's driven by weathering of phosphorus from the landscape coming in over slowly over time. So what we do in cultural eutrophication is we accelerate that time scale immensely by bringing more phosphorus into a basin. And then that lake starts to get green really quickly, increasing because algae and cyanobacteria need phosphorus, and phosphorus is relatively scarce in the environment. Just like, you know, farm fields need phosphorus. It's this inevitability. Unfortunately, if only crops needed something different than phosphorus to grow, then we wouldn't have this problem. We do have this problem. So in any case, it's just an accelerated version of this process where a lake will go from nice, clean, and clear and healthy to one that's producing the transparency declines, develops scums of sometimes positively buoyant algae that grows there. Sometimes the toxic forms are present, in which case it can be unhealthy to drink by humans and, you know, livestock and pets. Then there's an acceleration that can take place. Once you go across a certain threshold, you get so much production by the algae in the surface water that when it sinks to the bottom of the lake, as Gabe was talking about, the decomposition of that organic matter strips the oxygen out of the water. That kills the fish. Now it's really nasty. And then that lack of oxygen can cause more phosphorus to come out of the sediment. So now it's fueling, now it's running away. And that is a very, very bad situation that's difficult to recover from. So you don't want to cross those kind of thresholds. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of lake that, unfortunately, lots of people have seen their local systems go toward. Right.
Or they've seen a small pond that they even have that will go through that cycle. This has been really great. I want to thank both our guests, Dr. Jim Elzer and Gabe Filippelli, for being with us to talk about phosphorus. And do check out Jim's book.
Phosphorus Past and Future.
Great. And until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.